This is Audible.
HarperCollins and Harper Audio presents The Truth About Aaron, My Journey to Understand My Brother, by Jonathan Hernandez, read by Josh Bloomberg. Preface. To many, my younger brother, Aaron Joseph Hernandez, was a monster. I understand how some people could think he got the fate he deserved. He definitely caused destruction in my life, and I'm only now beginning to understand the meaning and impact of his actions. After Aaron was found guilty of murder, I found myself guilty by association, guilty of being his brother. In May 2015, a month after the jury delivered the verdict, I started going by Jonathan, my middle name, instead of DJ, as had always been known. I needed a new beginning. During one of my prison visits, I told Aaron about my name change. He understood why I wanted to do it, given the negative attention focused on him. Aaron and I talked on the phone at least once a week after his conviction. Over 1,000 miles apart, he in a Massachusetts prison and me in Iowa, I could still feel his smile through the phone. In prison, he sounded more at peace to me. He was beginning to overcome the inner demons he had been facing, demons that had been growing inside of him long before our father passed away in 2006. It was painful for both of us when I visited Aaron in person because of the restrictions on our interaction, the shackles on Aaron, and the plate of glass between us. Still, while serving his time, Aaron became more reflective and honest with himself about the mistakes he had made and the life he had once led. "DJ, please embrace life," he said to me during one visit. "Embrace all of what's right in front of you. Please embrace it like it could be gone forever. This is something I wish I would have done." Moments after he uttered these words, a corrections officer interrupted and said, "Time's up." Aaron had to report back to his cell. He hung up the phone, stood from his small metal stool, and placed his hand on the glass wall. "I love you, Dee," he said. I matched my palm against his. "I love you too, Aaron," I said. Aaron moved toward the exit door, where the officer awaited him. I walked along with him on the other side of the glass, maintaining eye contact, trying to hold on to our final moments together, before he vanished. Aaron was a star player for the New England Patriots when his NFL career was cut short by his 2013 arrest and 2015 conviction for the murder of Odin Lloyd. He ended his life 2 years later. According to prison officials, a corrections officer found Aaron in his cell at Sousa Baranowski Correctional Center in Lancaster, Massachusetts, at 3:03 a.m. on April 19, 2017, lifeless. He had tied a bedsheet around his neck and hung himself from the window bars. Cardboard had been shoved into the tracks of Aaron's door to prevent it from being opened, and shampoo had been spread across the floor to make it slippery. They also said that Aaron had a fresh cut on his right middle finger. On his forehead, he wrote, John 3:16, in blood. He also smeared his blood on the page of the biblical passage that reads, "For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life." At the time of his death, at 27, Aaron was 2 years into a life sentence with no chance of parole. 5 days earlier, he had been acquitted in a second trial for another murder outside a Boston nightclub a year before Lloyd was killed. I last spoke to my brother just 3 days before he died. Now I constantly replay the final time I heard his voice. I was 3 years older than Aaron. Growing up in Bristol, Connecticut, a city 20 miles southwest of Hartford, we were virtually inseparable. Many evenings we would race each other to the top of a big hill that crested on our street, and then, catching our breath, look down at the bright city lights below. Sitting together, we would laugh and talk about our dreams. There were frightening times, too. During childhood, in the tiny bedroom we shared on Greystone Avenue, I'd wake up in the middle of the night to Aaron's screams. "They're going to get me," he'd yell. "They're going to get me." Our mother would rush into our bedroom, sit on his bed, and cradle him in her arms as tears streamed down his face. Nothing could soothe him. As she rocked him, he'd keep mumbling, "They're going to get me. They're going to get me." During one of my final visits with Aaron, he told me, "One day, I hope my truth is told." That is the intention of this book, to share the entirety of his story. As painful as this has been for me to relive, no secret will be suppressed, no event will be whitewashed. Since Aaron's passing, I've reconnected with family members and friends. I've spoken to many of his past associates, law enforcement officials, experts studying the brain disease known as CTE, and former teammates. I've revisited the places of his greatest triumphs, and also the scene where Odin Lloyd was murdered. I've re-examined our past together and what led to his double life and his tragic downfall. Through it all, I've asked myself, could I have done anything more to help Aaron? Could anyone have saved him? It is my hope that sharing the truth about Aaron might help others. Chapter 1. April 19th, 2017. The winding country roads in Connecticut were empty that pre-dawn April morning as I steered my SUV to Ledyard High School, where I was the head football coach. At 5:05 a.m., I pulled into the empty parking lot and made my way to my classroom on the first floor. One of my volunteers met me in my office to review the goals for our workout with the football team. Then, carrying my clipboard with a whistle draped around my neck, I descended two flights of stairs into what some of the older teachers called the bomb shelter, the basement of the school that housed our weight and wrestling rooms, to begin the team stretch. With 20 minutes remaining in the hour-long workout, I looked up and saw Pete Vincent, a physical education teacher, standing in the weight room doorway. "You have to cancel the workout," he said. "Why? What's going on?" "You just have to," he said. "Pete, let's step outside." We went into the nearby wrestling room. Pete took a couple of deep breaths, then said, "Aaron passed away this morning. He committed suicide in his prison cell." My knees buckled, and I stumbled to a nearby concrete beam to brace myself. I closed my eyes, trying to process what I had just heard. "Thank you for telling me, but there is no need to cancel this workout. I can finish." I clenched my jaw through the remaining 10 minutes, then dismissed the team. I was broken. I locked the weight room, turned off the lights, and headed for the door. I needed to get to my mother right away. I grabbed my bags from my office and race-walked into the mild spring morning to my car. I opened the door, sat behind the wheel, and sobbed like I'd never sobbed before. When I collected myself, I dialed my mom's number. "Are you okay?" she asked, an audible catch in her voice. She told me she had been in her bedroom in her condo, getting ready for her day, when her husband, watching television on the first floor, screamed for her. She ran down the stairs and saw the news on ESPN. "I'm coming to see you," I said, as I turned the ignition. As I drove, the rising sun casting a blush of pink light into the New England sky, I thought about the last time I saw Aaron in prison. I knew something wasn't right. I remembered the paranoia I saw in Aaron during his final days as a free man, the knife he kept on his nightstand, his changing behavior. I never imagined the depth of the darkness he was falling into. My mother met me outside on her porch. "How did it get to this?" I said, as we hugged and cried. We stepped inside and talked for an hour about his suicide because it didn't make sense. I can't believe he's gone, I said. I just can't believe it. Mentally exhausted, I excused myself to lie down upstairs in the spare bedroom. As soon as I settled under the covers, I heard the front screen door creak open, then slam shut. I bolted out of bed. From the top of the staircase, I could see a reporter peering inside the front door window. I ran back to the bedroom, looked through the blinds, and saw him returning to the other half-dozen reporters lined up at the end of the street. When I felt the vibration of the garage door open, I went downstairs to find my mother confronting another reporter. "Get off my property!" she yelled. Once I felt comfortable leaving my mother alone, I decided to drive back to my apartment in Groton, 90 minutes away. I couldn't wait to hug my wife and our 5-month-old daughter. Earlier that morning, I didn't have much time to talk to my wife because of how fast everything was happening. I left my mother's condo and entered my car. I flipped on the ignition, yanked my sun visor down, and pulled my hooded sweatshirt over my forehead. As I drove away, reporters with notebooks and cameras approached my slow-moving vehicle. Chapter 2. 20 years earlier. "Time to get up," our mom said from the foot of my bed where she stood at the ironing board pressing her clothes. She ironed in our room because it was the best space in our small house. She didn't want the board in the middle of the living room for guests to see. "Time to get moving." I opened my eyes and checked the clock. 6:30 a.m. Aaron was a few feet away, on his twin mattress, face down, mouth open, snoring, with his knees tucked into his chest and his butt up in the air. I was 9, and Aaron was 6. Outside the bedroom window, the gray sky was filled with snowflakes, our backyard covered in a sheet of white. "School's canceled. You're going to the babysitter." Our mother, Terry, still had to go to work. She was 5'4" and 135 pounds, but she had a strong Italian personality and was old-school strict. She was a secretary at our elementary school, less than a mile away. Our father, Dennis, a 5'10", 240-pound, charismatic Puerto Rican, was a custodian at a middle school in town. He normally worked the late shift, so most mornings, as Aaron and I walked through the hallway toward the kitchen, we'd see his big belly pushing up the covers on his bed. Today, he was already at the school, plowing the parking lot and shoveling the sidewalks. Aaron and I brushed our teeth and quickly put on our winter layers: wool socks, sweatpants, snow pants, and sweatshirts. We headed to the kitchen, where our mother had our lunches packed in 2 brown paper bags, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches with the crust cut off, fruit, a Twinkie, and an "I love you" note for each of us. We slid on our big puffy coats, our winter hats and boots, and then hopped into our red minivan for the 4-minute drive. These snow days were extra special to us, because when we played football, we got to tackle on the unplowed street, no more two-hand touch. That day, we played a pickup game at the end of the cul-de-sac with a couple of the kids from the neighborhood, 2-on-2. I was the quarterback and Aaron was my receiver. In our huddle, I called the plays from our playbook: pass in the grass, out to curb left, double move to the basketball hoop. Aaron ran the route and I flung him the ball. The boys we were playing were older than us, but we loved the challenge, especially when they talked trash to us. Our dad always told us not to speak to our opponents because it was a waste of energy. The 4 of us then went tramping through the nearby woods. We climbed trees, played hide-and-seek, and sprinted after each other in our custom winter version of Capture the Flag. If a snowball hit you in the other team's territory, you had to run back to your flag and touch it before you could rejoin the action. Around noon, it was time to return to our babysitter's house to eat lunch and dry our winter jackets, snow pants, hats, and gloves. We agreed to meet in the street in a few hours for the afternoon rematch. We ate fast, anxious to return outside. But then, one of the older boys at the house, a teenager, asked us to play a game of indoor hide-and-seek. This boy, who was in high school, frightened us. He was a bully, and his brother scared us with knives that he flashed at us. I bolted upstairs, wedging myself into a bedroom closet. Aaron went into a blue tent on the first floor. For 5, 10, 15 minutes, I remained in the dark closet, annoyed. I didn't understand why no one came looking for me. I found out much later, when Aaron was in prison, that the older boy had actually forced Aaron into the tent. "Why would the two of you hide in there together?" I asked Aaron that afternoon. "That's not a smart hiding spot." Aaron didn't say a word. Back in our warm, freshly dried outfits, we were putting our snow boots on near the front door when Aaron said, "Tell me something funny, Dee. I need to hear something funny, Dee." Aaron always asked me to make him laugh when he was upset. I told him a joke, and then we went outside to play two-on-two basketball with our friends in the snow at the end of the cul-de-sac. I had no idea what he had just been through. Dinner time was at 5 o'clock on the dot, so at 4:45 p.m., we started sprinting back home from the babysitter's house, which was a quarter mile away. If we were late, our dad might take off his leather belt and whip us on the behind with it. "My legs are killing me," Aaron said. "I can't go faster." "Hurry, Aaron," I said, struggling for breath. "Hurry." Our mom greeted us at the front door, looking at her watch. After throwing our winter clothes in the hamper, the four of us, Mom, Dad, Aaron, and myself, sat down at our dinner table in our kitchen, where our mother served us steaming plates of lasagna. After eating, our mother did the dishes and made brownies. Then the four of us piled into our red minivan parked in the driveway. Our destination? Blockbuster Video. Our dad, riding shotgun, played the green light game on roads that were now clear of snow. At a red light, he turned to us and said, "Hey, watch this. I'm a magician. I'll tell you exactly when this red light will turn green." He counted down from 5. Then, seeing the light in the other direction flip from yellow to red, he yelled, "And now!" We fell for it every time. We were convinced he had superpowers. We weren't the only ones. Our father was beloved in Bristol, where over time he'd earned a nickname, The King. Every year, he hosted a 3-on-3 basketball tournament on our backyard court. The grill would be firing, the pig would be roasting, and the cars would be parked up and down the street. Sometimes we'd have 500 people watching the games, standing shoulder to shoulder, kids on their knees looking between the adults' legs. Others brought lawn chairs and would sit and gossip for hours. Our dad got physical on the court and dominated the grill, where he cooked burgers, hot dogs, and chicken. It was like he was everyone's best friend. Aaron and I played rock, paper, scissors in the back seat to see who would have first pick of the brownies when we returned home. We both loved the soft centerpieces without the crust. We pulled up to the blue and yellow Blockbuster sign shining in the night. This was our happy place. Aaron and I leaped out of the minivan and ran inside, filled with excitement. We carefully selected our movies to rent before moving to the candy aisle. We each were allowed to make one selection. Everything would be split 50-50. Once home, we hurried to our room to put on pajamas, white long johns and white tube socks. The four of us had our regular spots on the sectional couch in the living room. Dad was on the far left, facing the television, me next to him, then Aaron, then our mother. As the movie started, Aaron and I laid our heads on the same pillow. He stretched his feet over our mother's lap. I put mine over our father's. For the next few hours, we were just there together, a family, warm in the glow of the television. Our mouths covered in chocolate from the brownies, my brother and I fell asleep on the couch before the second movie began. The next morning, Saturday, began with a basketball game at the local Boys and Girls Club. Aaron was too young for the league, so he sat in the stands, eating a sausage egg and cheese sandwich as he cheered my team on. After the final horn, Aaron and I played a game of horse together, until the next team started their pregame layup lines. As we walked back to our car, I heard my dad say, "Aaron, why do you stand like a faggot, with your hands clasped on your stomach and your elbows glued to your ribs? It's feminine. Are you a faggot? Only faggots stand like that. There are no faggots in the Hernandez family." Aaron put his head down, and he placed his hands straight down by his sides. This wasn't the first and wouldn't be the last time our father grew angry over what he called Aaron's feminine posture. After dinner, the four of us returned to the living room for our final rented movie when the phone rang. Dad sprang up to answer it. A few minutes later, he re-entered the room. "The guys are going out for a few drinks," he told our mother. "I'm going to go with them."
"When will you be home?"
10:30.
"All right, Dennis," she said with a knowing chuckle.
Around 3 a.m., Aaron and I heard our mom walk past our bedroom to the kitchen, mumbling, "That fucking asshole, that fucking asshole." We heard her open the side door that led to the driveway. Aaron and I slid out of bed and tiptoed to the kitchen. Aaron took a knee so I could use his thigh as a boost onto the counter to look out the window. Our dad was leaning inside the driver's window, talking to his buddies. My mother stood behind him with her arms crossed, yelling,
"Dennis, get your ass inside or get the fuck out of here."
As our dad turned and started stumbling toward the house, I jumped off the counter, and Aaron and I rushed back to our bedroom. With my head against our cracked bedroom door, I could hear them arguing. I relayed to Aaron what was going on.
"Why the fuck do you have to embarrass me like that in front of my friends?"
our father yelled. Our mom grabbed the rotary phone from the wall and smashed it over his head, shattering the phone into pieces. Then she stubbed the burning ember of her cigarette into his forehead, causing red ashes to fall in the dark. Our parents shoved their way into the hallway bathroom. Aaron and I snuck out into the hall. We saw our dad slamming our mom's head against the white sink, over and over, until she slumped to the ground. As my dad stood above her, they both looked our way.
"You see this coward, boys?"
our mom yelled from the bathroom floor as blood streamed down her forehead.
"He's a piece of shit. He thinks he's tough because he can beat a woman."
Aaron and I ran back to our beds. Aaron was crying, so I got on his bed and held him in my arms.
"Say something to make me laugh, Dee," Aaron whispered.
This time, I had nothing to say. Chapter 3. I hated the belt, hated the hangers, hated my father's hand. Our father would hit us for anything from a bad grade to disrespectful behavior to sheer clumsiness. One morning, when I was 9, he lifted me up by my left arm and, with my legs dangling in the air, he spanked me repeatedly, hitting me on the rear end each time he said a word, as was his custom. I always hoped he wouldn't have a lot to say. Aaron was next to me sobbing as I took my beating for accidentally spilling my cereal.
"Are you crying?"
my dad asked Aaron. He dropped me and turned his anger toward Aaron, taking him by the arm and administering another beating. After a few minutes, our dad left the room, leaving Aaron and me on the floor, wiping our tears with our shirts. Whenever Aaron and I sensed a beating was coming, we ran into our bedroom. As our father got closer, we could hear his footsteps on the wooden floor and his belt buckle clink as he started to take it off. We would crawl underneath our beds and put our backs flush against the wall. Every time he reached for us, we sucked in our stomachs, trying to keep his searching fingertips from grabbing us. Eventually, he'd become frustrated and leave, saying, "You have to come out of your bedroom at some point." When it was quiet and we felt safe, Aaron and I would emerge from underneath our beds and embrace each other with tears in our eyes, snot running out of our noses, dust on our shirts and shorts, wondering if we were in the clear. Some days we were. Others we weren't. Once, I told our dad I was going to call the Department of Children and Families, and he handed me the phone before saying, "Call them. As soon as you hang up the phone, I will beat you boys harder than you've ever been beat before. They will have to pull me off of you after they break down the door." One evening, Aaron and I were at the kitchen table, trying to finish our homework so we could attend the big high school basketball game with our dad. About a mile from our house, Bristol Central High was hosting crosstown rival Bristol Eastern. I was in eighth grade, Aaron was in fifth. With tip-off approaching, I worried that I wasn't going to finish in time to make the game. Aaron had completed his assignment and was getting dressed. Nervously, I tapped my pencil on the table as I thought about a question for my homework assignment I was trying to answer. A few minutes later, I mindlessly tapped my pencil again on the table. Just then, I felt something stab into my scalp, 2 inches above my forehead. I reached up and pulled the 2 prongs of a vacuum cord out of my head. When the blood began to pour, I started screaming. Aaron ran into the kitchen and started screaming too. The right side of my face was covered in blood. I thought I was going to die. I kept a towel pressed against my head for the rest of the night. I didn't make the game. Late that evening, after Aaron and my dad returned from the game, I heard my parents talking. "It has to stop," my dad said. "It was too close of a call tonight." Chapter 4. September 12th, 2003. It was game day, and we couldn't wait to get on the field. Aaron and I were just hours away from playing in our first varsity football game together. Aaron was a 13-year-old freshman wide receiver, and I was a 17-year-old senior quarterback at Bristol Central. That morning, I woke up before Aaron. I unraveled the clothes iron cord from my feet, because my legs hung off the end of my bed and underneath the ironing board my mother used. I sat on the edge of my bed for a few minutes, just looking at Aaron sleeping, my best friend. I thought about all the times we had attended high school football games at Muzzy Field in Bristol as children. Under the stadium lights and behind the bleachers, we played tackle football with other kids as the game was going on. When the crowd roared, I'd look at Aaron and tell him, "One day, we'll be out there together." Aaron finally woke up and had to pull his legs out of the hamper at the end of his bed. "Good morning, Dee," he said, rubbing the crud from his eyes. We had a small closet. Aaron and I shared the left half, while our father's clothes occupied the right side. Our mother had ironed all our outfits the previous weekend. Now, on Friday, only 2 items remained on the plastic hangers on our side. Our maroon game jerseys. Aaron wore number 15. I wore number 14. We got up and walked to our bathroom to brush our teeth. We nudged each other for sink space, competing to see who could keep their toothpaste spit away from the clean faucet while being elbowed in the stomach. We made weird faces at each other, trying to force a laugh so the toothpaste would fall onto our chin or splatter onto the mirror. When he was younger, Aaron was ice skating for the first time at our cousin's birthday party at an indoor rink. Aaron challenged another kid who was an experienced skater to a race. Aaron was in the lead as they neared the first turn, but Aaron forgot one thing. He didn't know how to turn on skates. So he kept flying straight and smashed his head into a wall. Everyone at the rink turned to the source of the loud bang. Aaron dropped to the ice, landing on his back. He got right up, amazed at not being hurt. He didn't start crying until he noticed the blood coming from his mouth and dripping onto the ice. Our Aunt Lisa, seated at a nearby picnic table, cautiously shuffled in her shoes to him as fast as she could. She picked up his 2 adult front teeth off the ice, her eyebrows raised in shock. Aaron spotted them and let out a piercing scream. Aunt Lisa skittered off the ice back to dry ground and put the teeth in a Ziploc bag, but there was no saving them. Days later, a dentist fitted Aaron with 2 prosthetic front teeth. He would always have issues with them. Sometimes he'd bite into an apple and end up losing his teeth. Once his fake teeth were out, it looked like he had a pair of short number two pencils protruding from his gums. To get a rise out of me, he'd bring his head down just above the surface of the table and act like he was using them to write on a sheet of paper. Her abs would hurt from laughing. That wasn't Aaron's only hard collision as a child. In the summers, when our parents were at work, we loved to build and hammer things. So one day, when I was in third grade, we went into the woods in our backyard with a few friends and started hammering a piece of wood into a tree with nails. I was holding the board steady and our friend was banging on a nail. As he was hammering, the rusted hammerhead flew backward and smashed into the left side of Aaron's head. My heart stopped. Aaron dropped to the ground, landing on his butt. I rushed to him and saw he had blood oozing out of his ears and nose. "Am I going to be okay, Dee?" We were both scared. Aaron got up and was able to walk back into our house, where I used paper towels, peroxide, and Q-tips to clean him up. Many years later, I'm left to wonder, was this the first hit of many that affected my brother's brain? Our mother was in the kitchen, drinking coffee, smoking a cigarette, and reading the local newspaper. She always looked for sports stories about Aaron and me. She'd cut them out of the Bristol Press and tack them onto the bulletin boards above our beds. Aaron and I hated those articles, because they'd fall on our beds in the middle of the night, along with the sharp tacks. But our mom loved looking at them while she ironed. Aaron and I put on our jerseys and headed to school, our normal routine on game day. I was so excited. I couldn't get the game against Xavier High School out of my mind all day. I saw Aaron a few times in the hallways and made sure he understood the plays. "Dee, I know what I'm doing," he said. "You've told me 100 times already." When the final bell rang, Aaron and I went home to take a pre-game nap. When my alarm buzzed, we went to the living room and lay on the floor. Our father, who had just returned home from work, was sitting on the sofa. A few hours before kickoff, he always rubbed our feet with his strong hands. With blades of grass on his forearms and with dirt stains on his white tube socks, he dug into our arches to break up the soreness that had built up in our feet from the week of practice. I walked alone into my room and put on my maroon football pants and long maroon socks. I valued this time. I looked over the play sheet that was wrapped around my left wrist. I wanted to be perfect, especially because it was our season opener and my first varsity game with Aaron. We had both worked so hard for this moment. Sometimes, when I couldn't sleep, I'd roll out of bed, tiptoe to the kitchen door, slide on my shoes, flip on the side light, and go outside. Under the amber glow of the crackling driveway light, I'd jump rope with my blue weight vest strapped on. Aaron often woke up and joined me on the driveway. "Man, you are crazy," he'd say, shaking his head from the top of the steps. But then, seconds later, Aaron would be a few feet away, mimicking my motion, because we only had one jump rope and had to share. We'd only stop when our mother came to the door. "What are you doing?" she'd ask. "Come back inside and get to bed." Before bed every night, we'd see who could do the most push-ups and sit-ups. When one of us would stop, the other would say, "Hey, if you're not working now, someone else is." This was what our father often told us, and we repeated it to each other hundreds of times. We wouldn't quit until our muscles locked up. Other times before bed, we'd compete to see who could plank the longest. We'd hold the position and stare at each other, waiting for the other one to drop. Our entire bodies would shake, but we wouldn't give up until our bodies collapsed to the floor. Neither of us ever wanted to lose. If it was raining, we'd go to our basement and set up cones to run drills. We'd play tag, chasing each other around our pool table to improve our agility and quickness. We'd get on our knees and play tackle football. Other times, we'd run up the stairs from the basement, around the den wall, back down to the basement, and around the pool table like it was a track around a field. When our father returned home from work, we'd do everything in our power to convince him to join us on the driveway and throw us the football. Aaron and I would push and shove each other, trying to gain position in order to make the catch to impress our dad. I was older and stronger at the time, but Aaron always made it a battle. We'd play home run derby in our backyard. Once Aaron jacked one of my pitches through our parents' bedroom window. My mother poked her head out of what remained of the shattered glass and asked what the hell happened. Aaron replied, "I finally hit his curveball." When it was time to return to school, where we would meet up with our team for the ride over to the stadium, our dad followed us to the car. He gave us a hug and a kiss goodbye, and we got in. I rolled down the driver's side window, and as I backed out of the driveway, he strolled along with us, shouting words of encouragement, until we reached the end of the driveway. For years, our father had talked about how special the day was going to be when his two boys took the high school playing field together, and now that day had arrived. Aaron was the only freshman on our team, and I worried that he was nervous. He had as much athletic ability as any of the wide receivers on our team, but he was too young to know it. I told him that the locker room was quiet on game day, much different than after school on practice days. "When you're getting dressed, I want you to envision what you have to do and how you're going to get it done," I said. I continued, "Before you run with the football tonight, make sure you exaggerate every catch with your eyes. Look the ball all the way into the tuck. Play hard on every snap." He nodded. "Also, the first time I touch the ball, I'm going to score tonight." He thought I was joking and started laughing. "I did it last year, and I'm going to do it again," I said. "You just watch." He looked at me as if I were out of my mind. We parked near the custodian's entrance. We both put our headphones on and listened to our slow jam mix, Boys to Men, Jagged Edge, to keep us calm before releasing all of our energy on the field. Through the cafeteria's glass windows, I saw two yellow school buses lining up with their engines running, waiting to take our team to Muzzy Field, our school's home stadium for football and baseball games. After a brief team meeting, in which we reviewed our first few offensive plays and discussed last-minute adjustments, I grabbed my gear and the game ball and walked outside. I met Aaron on the sidewalk. He stood about 10 yards away, and I took a 3-step drop and threw him a pass. Aaron exaggerated the catch, tucked it, and tossed the ball back to me. The team loaded onto the two buses. I took a seat and Aaron sat behind me. Aaron put his hands on my shoulders and squeezed. He whispered into my right ear, "You're going to dominate today." "You are too," I said. "We've been waiting a long time for this. Let's both have a day." I was always the last one off the bus, so I could watch my teammates in their maroon uniforms stride into the stadium. Aaron waited for me to rise, but I told him to walk out in front of me. I followed closely behind. As soon as we got off the bus, we could smell the burning coals in the concession stand grill. The yellow-jacketed event staff was busy getting the stadium ready for the crowd. I slowed as I neared the front entrance. Every time I reached this spot for our home games, I paused. My dad had played here. My uncles had played here. Even Babe Ruth played here when he was in the minor leagues. In the old-time locker room, I sat in front of my wooden locker, my eyes closed, visualizing the game ahead. Then I tied the laces on my black Adidas cleats and jogged onto the field. I loved feeling the crunch of the gravel underneath my feet as I ran past home plate, down the third baseline before reaching the left field grass, where we warmed up. Aaron was already out on the field. Aaron was physically mature beyond his age, and so skilled that my father often said, "When Aaron develops, he will be special. He's as gifted as they come." When Aaron was in the 7th grade, he could dunk a basketball. He was an all-around better athlete than I was, and I never possessed his leaping ability. It got to the point where I told Aaron, "Look, if you want to play horse with me, you can't dunk because I can't." Aaron would nod his head and then we'd go outside to play, but then his very first shot would be a tomahawk jam. "What did I just tell you?" I'd say. "Oh yeah,"
he'd say. Then he would smile at me. It was his way of playfully sticking it to his older brother. We challenged each other often as kids. One time, at a restaurant, Aaron boasted he could eat a 4-pound burger. He was only 12 at the time, and as his older brother, I knew how to push his buttons. "Aaron, there is no way you can eat that entire thing," I said. Aaron ordered the burger. It filled the entire plate. A few big bites in, his face already covered with ketchup and cheese and beef juice, he looked at me with his mouth full and said, "Dee, there's no way I can finish this." We both started laughing. We gave the leftovers of the burger to our dog, an 80-pound purebred white German shepherd named Yukon. We loved to take a football outside with Yukon and try to juke him and run past him on our narrow driveway. He'd nip at our legs and sometimes grab hold of our pants and rip our clothes as we tried to move past. It was a nerve-wracking game, but we wanted to replicate what it was like running away from defenders on the football field. When it was extremely icy outside, we'd go to a local mall to have a catch. In an empty passageway, the football in my hands, I'd get into my quarterback stance and then take a 5-step drop. I'd shuffle to the left, to the right, and then forward to replicate escaping an oncoming pass rush. Then I'd yell, "Now!" And Aaron, standing 20 feet away and pumping his arms, would either turn back to me to mimic a curl route or turn away from me like he was running a comeback route. A security guard usually asked us to leave after 30 minutes, but that work in the mall was important to us. Aaron and I stood next to each other on the sideline, kickoff against Xavier High seconds away. We spotted a banner that cheerleaders had made and taped onto the green left field fence that read, "The Hernandez Boys, number 14 and number 15. Xavier received the opening kick and marched down the field for a touchdown, taking a 7-0 lead. Our team trotted onto the field to return the ensuing kickoff. The blockers on our return team all executed their assignments and cleared the path for my 90-yard touchdown return. Aaron grabbed me after I said a prayer in the end zone, hugging me. "I can't believe you scored," he screamed. "You said you were going to do it, and you did." Later in the first quarter, we had the ball at midfield. A receiver brought the play into the huddle from the sideline, and I relayed the call to my teammates. I received a shotgun snap and looked at my first progression to the right, but the rush forced me to slide to my left. I looked downfield and spotted Aaron, who was running a drag route across the middle of the field. I hit him in stride, and he ran down the right sideline as if his shoelaces were on fire. He dashed into the end zone, his first catch and his first score as a high school player, and my first touchdown pass to my brother. The crowd thundered. With my hands raised toward the sky, I sprinted after Aaron, who was celebrating with teammates in the end zone. Right before I reached him, I pointed upward, and we both jumped as high as we could to chest bump. My forward momentum knocked Aaron to the ground on his back. Laughing, I helped him up. I pressed my face mask against his and said, "Great play, Aaron, great play!" We jogged to the sideline together and shifted our eyes to the bleachers, where our family members and friends were jumping up and down, causing the metal stands to rattle and shake. As we neared the bench, we spotted our father in his maroon fleece. Clapping slowly and nodding his head, he looked directly at us, his lips quivering and tears falling. My mother's arms were around him. Together, Aaron and I pointed up to him. He clenched his right fist, pumped it in the air a few times, and then hugged our mother tight. On this Friday night, under the muzzy field lights, his dream and our dream came true. We won the game 44-14. After our head coach addressed the team on the field, I started walking toward the locker room when I noticed my dad in the distance, leaning up against the chain-link fence, alone. I ran back to him. "What's wrong, Dad?" I asked.
"Nothing, Dee," he said. "I am just so proud. We've come so far. I'm so thankful for you, for Aaron, and for Mom. I love you boys so much."
He wiped the tears of happiness from his cheeks. We hugged, and I sprinted to the locker room,
where my teammates and my brother were dancing and cheering. We rode the team bus back to Central, and then Aaron and I drove home. Our father and mother were waiting for us in the kitchen. Our dad opened his arms and pulled us in, a giant bear hug, holding the two of us so tight and not wanting to let go. "I am the luckiest father in the world," he said in a whisper. "I love you, boys. I could hold you both here forever." The four of us sat down at the kitchen table and ate cheese and pepperoni pizza. My mom told us our father was crying like a baby in the stands. Aaron and I mimicked his weeping face, making him laugh along with us. It was perfect. The four of us together. None of us wanted the night to end.
Chapter 5. October 7th, 2005. 2 years had passed since Aaron and I played at Bristol Central together, and now I was standing on the sideline of Rentschler Field in East Hartford, Connecticut, the site of the University of Connecticut football team's home games. Minutes before kickoff, I looked up into the first row of the bleachers and spotted my dad. Knowing he was there always calmed me. I was a redshirt freshman quarterback, and that preseason, Matt Bonislavski had won the starting quarterback position. Early in the second quarter in our Big East Conference matchup against Syracuse, the Friday night game was broadcast on ESPN2, Matt went down with a broken collarbone. I started taking snaps and throwing the football on the sideline. My father yelled to me, "You got this, D." I looked up and saw my dad in tears. I entered the game and helped us win 26-7. 1 month later, I traveled to Newington, Connecticut during our bye week to watch Aaron, now a junior, play an away game. During the season, I wrote Aaron short motivational letters that he would tuck into his right sock every Friday night in the locker room. "Every play is an opportunity for you to prove that you are the best player in the country. I love you. Dominate today." When my mother pulled his maroon socks from the dryer later, they would be stained with ink. Aaron always wore those same socks on game day because he was superstitious and felt a part of me was with him. Aaron didn't know I was coming. With a black splint on my left wrist, I had broken it the week after the Syracuse game against Cincinnati, I sat in the stands for several minutes in silence, not wanting to make him aware of my presence. In my short time away from home, his body had rapidly filled out. He was a grown man out there, 6'2" and 220 pounds. He was the biggest and fastest player warming up on either team. My father and I sat with Randy Edsall, the head football coach at UConn. Coach Edsall had already offered Aaron a scholarship the summer before his junior year, and Aaron had verbally accepted. Now Edsall was there to evaluate Aaron in person for the first time. Minutes before kickoff, I walked down out of the visiting bleachers and leaned against a chest-high metal fence that circled the field. "Aaron!" I yelled. Aaron looked over at me, confused by my presence. He pulled off his helmet and sprinted across the blue track to the fence. "Good luck. I love you," I said. "By the way, Coach Edsall is here. Put on a show tonight." "Thanks, D," he said. "I love you. I'm so happy you're here." For the next 2 hours, Aaron flashed his potential, making play after play after play, one-handed catches, catches in traffic, and standout tackles from his defensive end position. Every time Aaron made a block, it was as if the defender were on roller skates, being driven backward. Coach Edsall couldn't sit still. He told my father during the fourth quarter, "I've never seen a high school player this talented in my life." Aaron finished the game with 9 catches for 376 yards and 4 touchdowns. On that night, he set a state high school record for receiving yards in one game, which was also the 7th best in national history. Chapter 6. December 2005. I drove home from UConn to spend my holiday break with my family. I walked through the white front door, and the smell of my mother's delicious beef stew filled the entire house. From the kitchen,
I heard a car door slam shut in the driveway. I stepped out of the side door and met my father at his white Chevy Trailblazer. I had a haircut appointment and didn't want my car to be blocked in by his vehicle. He handed me his keys. I drove to my hometown barbershop to get a bald fade. Aaron had thin, spiky hair with a widow's peak, and I had thick, matted hair. Keeping our hair short worked in our favor. Returning home, I popped the trunk of my car to retrieve my two suitcases and workout gear. It was empty. I found all my bags neatly placed by my bed. I saw my dad in the kitchen. "You didn't have to bring in all my stuff." He grinned. "You're not the only one around here with muscles," he said, flexing his little biceps for me. "Come with me to pick up Aaron from basketball practice." Minutes later, my father and I were standing on the Bristol Central basketball court. Watching the end of practice, Aaron did everything with such ease, draining long-range shots and soaring to the rim for dunks on offense and rebounds on defense. "Every time I come back, Aaron gets better and better at everything he does," I said. "He could be an elite college basketball player if he wanted." Our dad had a golden rule for us when we played basketball growing up. We were never allowed to surrender an easy layup, even outdoors in the winter. On snow days, we'd shovel the court, but we'd slip and slide over the icy spots. If one of us drove hard to the hoop, we knew we would end up landing in the snowbank behind the basket. We took our dad's directive to heart. When we got cold, we would run inside, change our clothes, and gulp down a cup of hot chocolate that our mother made for us. Then we'd head back into the freezing afternoon for more basketball. The only thing that interrupted our games was the snowball fights that broke out between us and other kids in the neighborhood. Even though Aaron was the youngest in our group, he could sure fire a snowball. But we could also argue and fight with each other like brothers. There would be times Aaron and I would be in our basement playing Madden NFL 95 on our Sega Genesis. I would call him Beaver and he would call me Rat Tail, our childhood nicknames for each other. We'd be having fun, talking and horsing around, and then as quickly as a light switch being flipped, Aaron would snap and start hitting me on the wrist with his controller or claw at my face with his nails. I'd run up the cellar stairs and he'd chase me as I yelled for my parents. Once he calmed down, I'd ask Aaron what happened. "Dee, it's like I black out," he'd say, with no further explanation. After practice was over, the three of us played a game of pig. Our dad was knocked out first, and then Aaron and I battled away, making shots until our dad told us we had to finish up. Before leaving the gym, Aaron and I made sure to make our last layup, our ritual. At home, we sat in our normal spots at the dinner table. Mom served the stew, and Aaron and I dug in. This was our dad's favorite meal. He loved to take the chunks of beef and put them on the soft, buttered Italian bread from Harvest Bakery and make a mini sandwich. But after a few minutes, we noticed he wasn't eating. "What's wrong, Dennis?" my mother asked. "I'm not feeling well," he said. "I'm going to lie down." Aaron and I looked at each other, confused. This wasn't like our dad. He rarely complained about anything, and he no longer missed meals or time with his family. Something wasn't right. My mom excused herself from the table to check on him as Aaron and I kept eating. She found him on their bed, lying on his back and staring at the ceiling. "What is it, Dennis?" she asked. "What's going on?" "I've got this shooting pain in my stomach. I've never felt pain like this before." "That's it. I'm taking you to the emergency room." "There's no need to worry," our father told Aaron and me, as he made his way to the front door after our mom went out to start the car. Still in our seats, at the table, Aaron and I didn't understand what was happening to our father. "He's tough," I said to Aaron. "He'll be all right." After running a few tests at the hospital, the doctor told my dad he had a strangulated hernia and needed surgery as soon as possible. The procedure was scheduled for the next day, New Year's Eve. Early the next morning, our father was rolled into the operating room. The surgery was scheduled for 2 hours, but lasted 8. Aaron and I went to the hospital that night, but our dad was sleeping. The next day, January 1st, Our dad was fully awake and appeared to be his normal self. He looked like he belonged at home. He laughed and cracked jokes with Aaron and me. He complained more about his pinky than his stomach. Back in his football playing days, his right pinky got caught in another player's face mask, bending it to a 45-degree angle. Instead of having surgery, he pulled it straight, but it didn't stay. Eventually, it stayed permanently bent. Now in the hospital, he asked us to pull it straight. As Aaron yanked, we heard the loud, low rumble of our dad farting, which made everyone in the room laugh and pull their shirts over their noses. "It was getting too tense in here," he said. "I'll be out in no time. Loosen up." We spent hours with him. Our father nestled between us in the hospital bed, the three of us cuddling. We played checkers, Connect Four, and Uno. That evening, a nurse asked him if he was strong enough to go on a short walk down a hallway. He said yes. Wearing a green gown and hospital socks, with his IV drip bag attached to his left arm, he inched forward alongside the nurse. Aaron and I followed and watched from behind. When the back of his gown swung open to reveal his flat, tan butt, the two of us laughed like it was the most hilarious thing we'd ever witnessed. Our dad turned back to us and winked with a sly smile, which made us laugh even harder. Later that night, as Aaron and I left the hospital, we thought he looked ready to come home. The next afternoon, January 2nd, I visited Dad by myself. His room was dark and silent. No one was visible. I thought I'd opened the wrong door, but then I noticed a night lamp shining down on my father, who was shivering underneath his blankets. As I neared him, he lifted his eyelids ever so slightly. He whispered, "Hey, Dee." I could barely hear his raspy voice. I leaned over and gently kissed him on his forehead. I'd never seen my dad this weak. I knelt so my face was right in front of his. "What's wrong, Dad?" I asked. "Not a good day, Dee. Not a good day." I lowered the bed rail and crawled in next to him, hoping my touch would comfort him. I rubbed his dark eyebrows and hair, trying to soothe him. "Not a good day, Dee," he said again. I didn't want my father to see my worry, so I closed my eyes and remained silent. "Are you okay?" he asked. I couldn't answer. Silently, I told myself, "Be strong. Be strong. He needs my strength." A few minutes later, he said, "Dee, I need to get some rest." I gave him one last squeeze in bed, then asked the nurse for another blanket. I tucked it tightly around him. "Hang in there, Dad," I said. "Everything will be better soon." I bent over and kissed him again on his forehead. "I love you, Dad," I said. With his eyes shut, in a barely audible voice, he said, "I love you, DJ." I have to be strong for my mother. I have to be strong for my brother. I have to be a man. At the lowest elevation of our hill, I parked my car. Flipping on my flashers, my forehead resting on the steering wheel, I was shredded by the thought of life without my father. As I walked in the house, my mother was getting ready to leave for the hospital. Aaron already had left for his basketball game that night. Neither of them knew. About 10 minutes later, my uncle Vito picked me up and drove me to Aaron's basketball game. Sitting in his car, I stared at the dashboard. He spoke to me, but the words didn't register. I thought Aaron's game would distract me from my father. I loved witnessing Aaron's growth as an athlete, yet as soon as the game started, I knew that wasn't going to happen. My mind remained on my father. On the court, Aaron, for the first time, appeared winded in an athletic contest. When the other team took foul shots, Aaron, hands on knees, bent over, looked directly at me. Aaron scored 29 points, quietly. The following day, the doctors informed my mother that our father was in toxic shock. His organs were shutting down. Early in the morning of January 5th, her mother woke us up. She had large purple rings around her eyes. Her hair was frizzy, sticking out in every direction. She looked like she hadn't slept in days.
"Dad had to go to the ICU last night," she said.
"What's the ICU